First is, I like a martini. Two at the most. Three I'm under the table. Four I'm under my host. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Under My Host. I'm Corey. Producers Porter and Tyler are here today.
Hello.
My guest host, Erin Jimkoski, Craft by Under My Host. She's our food editor. Dave Weglars, still 630.
Hello.
John Little of Smooth Ambler Spirits.
Hello.
Hello. And we have Wes Mickle of Argus Cidery. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Everybody's been a guest or a guest host before, so it's nice to have you guys back. And our guest today from Osakalis.
Yes.
Did I get it? Dan Farber. He's a founder and distiller. This is probably our most educational program that we're ever going to have. I'm excited. Actually, Dan was pretty adamant about not doing a brand show. He really wanted to educate us on brandy, production of brandy. And so we're going to learn a ton.
Cool.
What we'll talk about, we do have lots of brandies to try. So maybe what we can do, Dan, is you walk us through production of brandy. You can let us know what you want us to try. To taste while you're talking. Does that?
Sure. And, in some respects, it's best for you guys just to sort of interject and ask questions. I think it'll probably make it a lot clearer for everybody. I can at least start the conversation. So,
well, do you mind? But before you do, I didn't get any information from you. So, what can you just tell everybody briefly about the distillery and just a little bit about yourself? I know you, just a little, and then we'll move on to the other.
Let's see. I started distilling in the early '80s and formed this company in the late 1980s. Originally, I was a brewer, and my original distilling experience really was around whiskeys. But being in California when I founded this company, it really made sense to me. What I really had hoped to do was to form a distillery that I thought at least had the chance to make something world class. I mean, and if I didn't do that, it was because I was no good at it, but not because the raw materials, location, you know, aging facilities or something weren't well placed for the products that we wanted to make. And so I early on converted on brandies. And so again, in the late 1980s, founded this company, and I've been doing it ever since. I wore a number of hats for a while. Meaning that my background, simultaneously with starting the distillery, I was a professor of geophysics and planetary physics and actually ran a large research group in condensed matter physics as well.
Holy shit.
So basically, when you say distilling isn't rocket science, actually, the man's case it actually. Well, you know, that's really interesting because really early on, I said that I decided to do brandy because I felt what we may have here in California is really world-class fruit. And I mean that broadly. Since I had decided to make brandy, the first thing I wanted to do was go to places around the planet where they made great brandy and learn about how they made great brandy. Some of my first forays were to Cognac, and they still are. I'll be going there in a week and a half. I continuously go back. But really early on, I sort of came to the conclusion that some of the greatest brandies that were being made by small producers. Indeed, the large producers, I could call out, a few names, but by doing that, I'd leave others out. But so the large producers do, in fact,
in many cases make truly spectacular products, but not that much better than the greatest of the really small producers. And when I say really small producers, still today, cognac is the land of small producer. By law, you're limited on the size still you can actually have in cognac. So, you know, the larger distillation houses just have to have more and more stills. But in fact, it's primarily cooperative, with many, many small distillers providing raw eau de vie for the large blenders and bottlers. But those small producers were really doing things without all the technical background that I, in fact, had. So, you know, if you visit a modern lab at a large facility, you're going to see vibrational spectroscopy, absorption spectroscopy, you know, mass spectroscopy, you know, really high degree of technical expertise in terms of making the product that they want to make. But people just sitting in the barn doing, you know, distillation by distillation, one or two people at a time, I came to realize had the ability to do just as good a job, because the one tool that everybody has, although some better than others, is your nose, and that's an amazingly effective instrument at being able to discern quality characteristics in distilled spirits. So even though my background's quite technical, our approach here to production is absolutely non-technical. So if you came and visited my distillery, it would probably be one of the least technologically advanced you'll visit anywhere. I mean, literally, the most complicated instrument we have is one thermocouple, and we only have one. It's actually platinum RTD, but that's it. So that's really our approach. So I said that I wanted to make brandy, but even at that time, it wasn't clear to me. Well, probably the only rational business decision I've ever made along the lines was to not do traditional white eau de vie, which I love. And I still visit Alsace every couple years now to visit and distill with friends if possible. And I do some distillation sometimes in the summertime in Europe of traditional white eau de vie.
But Dan, for anybody that doesn't know what eau de vie is, will you just give them, will you just explain what that is and how that plays into brandy production?
Yeah, and so we use eau de vie in a number of different ways. We here make traditional brandies for long-term aging. Those are based on grape and apple, and we can talk a little bit about the sort of classical styles that are made around the world. And the thing that comes out of the still we refer to as eau de vie. But what I was talking about is the tradition in Eastern Europe and Central Europe of making brandies that are quote-unquote unaged, because the best of them are aged as well, but it's something neutral, stainless or glass, not wood. But there we use the term eau de vie for a white spirit, usually based on a range of classes of fruit that are brandies themselves. So the classic ones you might know of are Kirsch, cherry brandy, a Quetsch or Svetska, a plum brandy, so taking a step backwards before we take a step forward, the definition of brandy is a distillate based on a fruit fermentation, whereas the definition of whiskey is a distillation based on grain fermentation, or has to be an enzymatic process, you know, with grain before you can actually ferment it. Fruit is directly fermented and then distilled, and anything that's made in that fashion is a brandy. And some of these fruit brandies I'm talking about are just that. They're fermented cherries, they're fermented plums, Poire William, fermented pears, Calvados, is fermented cider, apple cider, then distilled. But those white eau de vie, pear, plum, cherry, peach sometimes, strawberry sometimes, we refer to as eau de vie, just, you know, senso stricto. And so early on, even though I love those things, you know, I could rattle around here my collection of maybe 50 or 60 eau de vie from Alsace, Americans don't drink it. Americans don't really have a tradition of drinking a spirit after dinner, and so I didn't feel like we could really make the company go. There's only been one person in the United States who's really been able to tackle that with any success, and that was Steve McCarthy at Clear Creek.
He does an amazing job.
Well, didn't they? Were they just bought by?
They were.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, they were. So, yeah. Well, but he's really the only one that could sort of try to re-energize that tradition here in the U.S.
I think, and it's only because we didn't cover it, and Aaron's from, or also from that coast. I think St. George is doing.
That's right. Actually, you know what? I left that out. That's right. Lance took over from York, and he still does a line of beautiful eau de vie. I should have.
No,
that was just oversight.
We didn't cover it. It was something we would cover in the future. But yeah, I'm not an eau de vie drinker. I don't have a problem. It's not, but I do tend to prefer aged spirits. But yeah, I would love to learn more about it. But
you know, there's so I think you know one of the big or some of the largest misconceptions around spirits in general is really like people like or dislike things in many cases based on either a poor understanding of what the distiller's trying to achieve and where they fit in, you know, culinarily speaking. So in the case of, for instance, so I think when you look at brandy versus whiskey or, you know, aged spirits versus non-aged spirits, a lot of, if you're looking for one thing and you find another, sometimes we're disappointed, whereas when we go at it looking for what's really there, we find, wow, this is amazing. So with the eau de vie, with the classic eau de vie of Alsace, what you're really trying to capture is almost what the term eau de vie stands for, which is water of life. It's the essence of the fruit, the sort of pure flavor of summer or flavor of fresh fruit in the glass. So you know, when you pick up a glass of Kirsch, you know, it should really make your mouth water because you know there's sour cherries there. Or a great, great Poivrillon, you know, you really should smell a absolutely ripe pear in the glass. And so you're really trying to get dead on the nature of the fruit in the glass, and they're all white. And so sometimes many of the producers, especially, in Alsace will produce, you know, could be 20 different varieties of fruits and flowers and these kinds of things. And they're all white glasses, but you put your nose in one and it's a fresh plum, and you put your nose in another and it's a fresh pear, and you put your nose in another and it's elderflower or elderberries or, hairy mullein flower or just a range of things. And they all are there in the glass in their sort of, you know, living 3D, if you will, in the glass. But with aged spirits, that's really not at all what we're trying to do. In fact, it's really quite different. With aged spirits, we're trying to achieve something new and something different aside from just the bright, fresh fruit. And I think one of the easiest ways to understand that is, it's to sort of make an analogy with wine, where with great wine, if there is such a thing as terroir or something that's some regional character that can come through into a grape, we expect that the wines should carry that regional character with them, and they should carry the varietal character. So if we're making a wine from Pinot Noir, we should be able to recognize that Pinot Noir grape in the final wine, if it's Cabernet, if it's Viognier, or Marsan, we should be able to recognize both the place and the type, and if we're lucky, even the year. It should somehow integrate the climate that it saw over that year. But we don't drink grape juice with dinner. We drink wine. And that process of fermentation, the process of aging in barrel for some period of time, relatively short if you're a distiller, relatively long if you're a winemaker, transforms that grape juice and actually brings it a sort of a new character and a new life. It's really a transformational process to go from grape juice to great grape wine. But we retain some of those characteristics. The place, the time, the variety. in this sort of new form that is wine. And in the same way, brown spirits for aging, we do the same thing. We take that wine, we distill it, and through that distillation process, and then placing it in barrel for aging, we again undergo a similar transformation. But if we're good as distillers, as winemakers, and as aging and blending and the maître de chai, we should still be able to capture the place if it existed, the time if it existed. Was it a hot year? Was it a cold year? Was it high acid? Was it low acid? And the varietal characteristics, Pinot Noir, Viognier, Colombin, those all should be there in a great distillate. And yet, after 10, 20, 30, or in the case of some of the greatest of the greats that we know of, the Grand Champagne in Cognac, you can even go 100 years in wood and undergo a whole new series of transformations that give you a new character to the thing you're looking at. So when you're talking about after dinner and you're going towards an eau de vie, it's a very bright, fresh, fruity thing that you're looking for. And when you're really interested in an aged spirit, it's somehow something that has really marked the passage of time over the decades, if not centuries, in some cases. So, you know, when you approach it and you know where you're headed, then there's a place for all these things. I bet if you give it a try, you'll fall in love with eau de vie. I'll wager a bottle of brandy.
Okay. No, you know, it's not, it's just a little harsh for, I mean, even yeah, like there's like cabs are not my favorite wine, that like mouth yep. of alcohol. So it's not that I,
no.
Frambois, I mean, there's you things are. That I've tasted that I enjoy. It's just, they're not my, of all the things that I drink, I just gravitate towards them less. But I
no,
love hearing.
And you're right. And so that's another thing. And that's another thing that I think we as brandy manufacturers, the great ones, pay a lot more attention to structure in the mouth. And when you go to some eau de vie, the classic flaw in a good eau de vie as opposed to a great or an excellent eau de vie is that in many cases you can capture the nose, but when you go to put it in your mouth, it's hard mm-hmm. and angular and rough. And those are, you know, I mean, so those would be, you know, sort of good. But when it's great, when it's great eau de vie, when you put it in your mouth, it just bursts with ripe fruit and it's soft and supple.
Okay.
But as I said, many of the greatest producers are aging those eau de vies 5 to 8 years before putting them in bottle. And that's because the structure, even though a lot of the aroma can be there quite young, the structure and especially the mouthfeel really, really develops and gets round and mm-hmm. rich and supple after time. But it's very expensive, you know, and so, I mean, to do that, to hold on to these things. So,
right.
Dan, let me interrupt you here. Are they aging those eau de vies, the ones that you deem are great, are they aging those in stainless or in glass as opposed to wood to turn into a brandy? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they're all aged in stainless or glass. And the structure, so it's like, you know, people ask me a lot of times, like, do brandies age after they're in bottle? And the answer is, you know, sort of yes and no. If you take maybe this is a good time to take a sip. If you take a sip of our rare Alembic brandy, that's a brandy that we put together in a VSOP style. It's a youthful brand. It's a blend of things that are about 4 to 10 years old. Nothing younger than about 4 and really nothing older than about 10. And it's a style that's fresh, it's floral, it has actually elements of oak, wood, but oak. It has elements of spice, and that's what we call a VSOP style. Now, if you take that brandy when it was in barrel, and you leave it in barrel for another 20 years, let's say, or 10, it will actually change its character and be more like an XO, let's say. If you put it in bottle for 10 or 20 years, it will still be a VSOP style brandy forevermore. It's really not going to undergo that type of transformation. But in terms of suppling, rounding, getting rich and really harmonize, getting like harmony in the bottle. It does do that, actually. It does age. It just doesn't change its character. And so in the same way that these eau de vie, when they're held in stainless for, let's say, 8 years, they're not aging in the way we think of it when we think of barrel aging spirits, but they are really changing in terms of their structure and their suppleness, especially in the mouth. So
when they're in stainless, is there any sort of air interchange, or is it completely sealed, or how does that work?
It's sealed. And, you know, even if you take, so like for us, like when we take brandy, maybe we should walk through a little bit of the process of making brandy, but when we take brandy off of the still, it always has what we call this sort of taste of the still, you know, it's always angular and rough and even a little, so it takes, you know, a few months for even that just to sort of mellow out, you know, and go away. And it does, it always does. But, and that would happen whether we put it into barrel or not. That part of it. It's the transformational elements that really don't happen. So just to walk you through a little bit of the process of making brandy, and I should say brandy really, I would argue, is one of, I joke with John because he's like the most fun guy of my colleagues to joke with. You know, I'm like, hell, they give you your raw. Not only do they give you the raw ingredients, but I'm paying to subsidize them to give you your raw ingredients. But with the new farm bill and all.
I love talking anything political with John Little.
What?
No,
John and I get in a major pissing contest, but he is fun.
But I like to stir the pot.
You do.
But the raw ingredients for all brandies, fruit, you know, is actually quite expensive. It's really some of the most expensive raw ingredient you can use, aside from some of the really expensive elements you might use in gin, but there's more. They're not necessarily the base, right? They're flavoring ingredients. But at least from the viewpoint of a base spirit, brandies themselves are just incredibly expensive to make. Both because the raw ingredients, in our case, would be fresh grapes or fresh apples, are very expensive, and then also just to run a brandy distillery is expensive because you only get to produce once a year. One of the reasons why I was rushing around today is just last week, this is kind of brand new news, really, really brand new news. Just last week, we closed on a new 120-acre property that we're planting out. It's got 30 acres now in apples, and we'll switch some of that around, and we'll plant another approximately 30 acres dedicated to grapes for brandy distillation, and it's really going to be the first, or certainly one of the first new vineyards to go in, dedicated solely for grapes for brandy production. I've been out there almost every day for the past week trying to get stuff going. But until now we actually do farm our own grapes. But until then, the only part of the process we didn't do was farm our own grapes. We have long-term contracts with growers that grow grapes specifically for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we could talk a little bit about that.
I would love just for everybody to hear, you know, you could glaze over it as much as you can about the actual production. How does making brandy different from the process of making wine when you are starting with the same fruit?
So the first step to making great brandy is making great wine, because distillation only concentrates things.
Right.
It does, in fact, there are a few exceptions to this rule, but very few. So really, most flaws in wine will just become bigger flaws in brandy. And some flaws in brandy are not flaws in wine. For instance, acetaldehyde, you know, it's present in sherries, it's a positive note. In some wines, it's a positive note. if you were to distill those wines, it would be a negative note. It would be so concentrated in the brandies, it would just be a very, very negative note. So the wines that are produced, so we harvest our fruit once a year when the fruit's ripe, and then we make wine. And the fruit that we're harvesting for our wines is extremely high quality, but the wines we make are not ones that you would particularly want to drink at the dinner table. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the distillation process concentrates effectively by about eight or 10 to 1 is a good round number. So 10 to 1, the wine to the final brandy. And in that concentration of all those elements, notes that really weren't so predominant in the wine themselves now become quite noticeable in the brandies. And so we can take the fruit at a stage that is mature, fully mature, but not necessarily wonderful on the mouth and in the nose, because the things we're looking for are at too low a concentration in that fruit for us to get it in the still wine. And we're looking for a couple of things in those still wines. We're looking for very good acidity, very high acidity, very delicate notes. I think the easiest and best analogy, if you know wine, is to think of a grape champagne. Those delicate, very acidic, dry wines are exactly the kind and style that we're looking for brandy production. And if you know, like, Blanc de Noir champagnes made from Pinot Noir, the Pinot Noir wines that we use are very similar in nature, very, very, very little skin contact, very delicate floral aromas. And those really are the style of wine that we're making for brandy production. And then once the wine is made, really almost immediately after the fermentations are over, we begin distillation for the year. We have three Alambic Chante stills. So they're traditional stills that would be required by law if you were distilling in cognac. Conversation, I think, is the appropriate word, with my associate distiller here about many of the laws in cognac. And my argument is really many of the laws and regulations that dictate production in cognac are really there to provide coarse but quality controls. And so you must use an Alambic Charente if you're going to make cognac in cognac. And the Alambic Charente is a pot still in its most general form in three parts. There's the pot, which always is direct fired, never steam fired. It has a simple hat and swan's neck configuration, so never a rectification column. It has what we call a chauvin or a wine preheater. That's a part that's extra. Don't really need it, but excuse me. In some houses in cognac, it's part of the house style to use it. And so if you were to produce for those houses, Remy Martin, for instance, you'd have to have a still with a chauvin. And then we have the condenser. And the difference, if you will, visually, of the condenser in an Alambic Charente versus a condenser in another still or type of still you might be more familiar with is our condensers are gigantic. They're almost twice the size of the pot. And that's because what we're really trying to accomplish in the method de Charente is the slowest possible cooling of the vapor, not the fastest. So we could easily condense down the vapor in a much smaller condenser, but we want to do it as slow as possible. And so we use a very large condenser and go very slowly with the cooling water.
What effect does that have on the final product?
It's a lot, and that's because we really want the vapor that's produced in the pot to have as much time to react with the copper. Copper is a very important part of the distillation process. It both in the pot itself, it catalyzes many of the Maillard reactions that we're looking for. And here now is a sort of another difference between brandies for long-term aging and simple white eau de vie, where in the pot itself is like, it's not just And here, I sometimes get the hair on the back of my neck standing up straight when I hear some of my colleagues use the term stripping run for the first run of a distillate through a still, because it gives the impression that what you're doing is removing something that's there very fast, removing it first, quick. But in fact, the first distillation is the most critical distillation, and it's in French, it's called the Bouilly distillation, and we produce something called Bouilly, which is about 25% alcohol by volume. It's equivalent to the low wines in whiskey production. But the difference, and so there's really, you could say there was really no difference in those words, but the image that it connotes is quite different, in the sense that in the Alambic Charente, we use direct fire on the bottom of the bottom of a copper still, because it's a big chemical reactor at that point. You're boiling wine, and you're actually undergoing a myriad of chemical reactions, some of which are producing new elements, which we find really quite favorable. The one that we almost is sort of the canonical one that we think of is furfural. It gives sort of a coffee, good cocoa aroma to brandies. Well, furfural is not present in wine at all. It's only made in the still, and it's really good. It's good for illustration because it has a very high boiling point, and it's really soluble in water. Meaning, so three things: wasn't present in the wine. You only make it in the still. It takes a long time to make it in the still. It's a slow chemical reaction within the pot itself, and it only comes out in what you might call the tails, because it only comes out when the temperature in the pot is very high at the end of the distillation process, and it's very soluble in water, so it always wants to stay in the pot and really not come over in the vapor. And so the Alambic Charente is a very effective instrument for being able to coax out some of these cogenères that really don't want to come. And if you were to put a column on top of that still and rectify up to higher alcohol at each step, each one of those would effectively partition the furfural back down into the still, and it would get harder and harder to get it out, because you're cooling and always rectifying up to high alcohol content there. So just using what we call one theoretic plate or one actual plate and a simple hat and swan's neck configuration really is the one which gives us the ability to get the most general range of cogenère across into the distillate. So the first distillation, we put wine in the still, we heat it up, 1.5 hour heat time for us with very high flame and very high temperatures at the bottom of that pot, because we want to drive some of these reactions, and they go literally exponentially with temperature. So we want very, very high temperatures at that copper wine interface for about 1.5 hours. When we reach the boiling point, we lower the temperature way down to keep it at just bare, minimum boil. And then we will take off a fraction called heads. We put that aside. We collect this thing I just talked about called Bouilly, which is going to eventually be about 25% alcohol by volume. And possibly at the end, we would separate out a bit of tails, but typically here not. Maybe that's a level of detail we don't need to go into, but if anyone wants to know, we can ask. But and then the Bouilly, we get back about 1/3 of the volume that we started with the wine. So if we, like in our intermediate size still, it's a 330-gallon still, we'll get back about 110 gallons of Bouilly. So we need to do that 3 times before we can get enough Bouilly to refill the still for the second distillation, the Bonchot, for the good heat. And there, again, heat up phase comes over in the boil. Oh, and I should say, that first distillation takes about 12 hours continuous, 10 to 12 hours continuous distillation, start to finish. And now we have done that 3 times. So we collected enough to place back in the still. We heat it up again. We collect another section of heads. And now we collect, after the heads are separated, not necessarily removed. I mean, they're not thrown away, but they're physically separated. Then we collect the heart, which is the portion that we'll save for putting into barrel. And then after you get down to, in the, let's say, 60-some-odd percent alcohol someplace, we do this all by nose. we make what we call a cut and separate. That will, we'll take that barrel of brandy away. And then we collect something called the seconds, which is not tails, the seconds. And at the very end of the seconds, we might or might not collect what we call tails. the seconds, the heads, and if we did collect them, the tails are all recombined and redistilled. Because, as I said, in the case of that furfural, it's really coming across in the end of the seconds and the tails, and we want to sort of increase its concentration so we can move a little bit over into the end of the heart's cut. So we get a little bit of that in the brandy. And the heads themselves are really the most aromatic. They're the lightest boiling point fractions. They're the most aromatic. Indeed, some of them are, you know, you don't want too much of that in the brandy. But by reincorporating them and reacting them within the still, we get a brandy that's much better suited for long-term aging. And this is sort of a little bit counterintuitive, and that is, but you can think about it, but maybe not if we think about it in terms of the way we think about other things. If the brandies come out beautifully, like in, if we were to get them as crisp and clean and bright, as we could in the heart fraction at that moment when we collect it, they actually wouldn't be as well suited for long-term aging. We kind of want them, if you will, a little clunky. So we want a little bit more heads than we might like to, let's say, drink, you know, at that moment, and a little bit more of the seconds, so a bit wider cut on those brandies, because over time, decadal-like time, those will produce much more complex brandies after aging. And so, in fact, if the spirit were perfect or in its perfect form coming out of the still when we're collecting it, it really is not as well suited for long-term aging as it might be otherwise. So if we don't recycle those heads, tails, and seconds, you get a brandy that's fresher and brighter and crisper when it's young, like day one, but it doesn't age as well. It doesn't show as well later on.
I believe that's a problem that a lot of the craft whiskey guys are doing, a disservice that they're doing, which is, and so many of these guys are being taught heads, hearts, and tails cuts. And for vodka, for gin, or for something you're going to drink right away, I think it's hugely important to make really accurate cuts so that you're taking the heads and the tails out. But for you know, long-term maturation, for making really complex whiskeys, it's better to have a whiskey, as we like to say, that's a little dirty, right? That has these
more character.
More character, more spirit. You know, the barrel has something to react to.
But is that like what Dan was saying too, that some of these really small producers that are kind of just, you know, making this, you know, more like kind of with their hearts than with machines and technology, that the imperfections are, it's not maybe like this perfect spirit that the large producers are putting out, but they're a little bit more interesting?
I think it's actually the opposite. I think some of the craft guys are trying.
I meant the producers when he was talking about talking about cognac.
Well, yeah, Dan would speak to that, obviously. Yeah.
No, it's not as much that as much as it is that with experience, and I think with experience, you know what is right. So you can do with your nose. If you have a lot of experience and you have knowledge, you know where those cuts need to be made. You know what that brandy needs to smell and taste like today for it to be at its peak 50 to 80 years from now. And brandy, remember, brandy is the spirit that has the greatest ability to age. So the greats of the greats, the heart of cognac, the Grand Champagne, those brandies, to be honest, they don't even really hit their stride until they're about 40 years old. I mean, younger than about 40 years, in many cases, I kind of go, I'd rather be drinking a very mature Cinbois or Borderie, which can mature a bit, they reach their peak maturity a bit sooner, something like 25 or 35 years peak maturity. Whereas a Grand Champagne can go as I said, like let's say 80, sometimes even more years in barrel and still be improving from that barrel aging process. But that means that if you're distilling today and you're, let's say you're 40 years old, let's even say you're 20 years old and you're distilling a brandy that's going to go 80 years, right? The likelihood of you tasting it is low, you know, when it's at peak maturity. And that is one of the most fascinating parts, because it means that it has to be a multi-generational process. That information has to be passed from one generation to another. And you can do it through books, and you can do it through the, you know, things that are now, you know, on the internet, if they were there, but they're typically not. But you can't really do that, because it's all about a smell and a taste and an experience that you need to pass on to the next generation to say, this is what you're looking for, not that. Because you're not going to be here to see it. But I was here with my grandfather. We did these like at 60 years. This is, you know, these are, he showed me, like, when you do it this way, you get this one. And when you do it this way, you get that one. And this is the one that we want to make. And that's a really amazing thing, I think, still today, that information almost has to be passed on with a direct physical interaction with somebody who has that experience and who has that connection to the past. It's, you know, even with winemaking, of course, I joke with my winemaker friends. I mean, you know, if you just start a winery today and you have the greatest vineyard, you know, to draw from, and you know, you're the greatest winemaker on the planet and it's a great vintage, you could make, you know, the greatest wine of your career today. But that's almost impossible to do as a distiller, because learning about how to produce these things for aging takes a lot of time and a lot of interaction with others. And that, to me, that's the fun part. And it's also the part that makes it the most interesting. I do have a number of colleagues and friends that assure me with the perfect analytical instruments, which may or may not exist today, but if we had all the information, we could certainly put together a great aged spirit in the laboratory, because it's just the sum of all these different chemical elements. And potentially, theoretically possible, to me, it's one, uninteresting, and two, I've never seen it done. So that would be a task for somebody else. I sort of, for me, the art is really the more interesting aspect of it, not necessarily the science.
Well, Dan, I'm sorry. Does anybody have any questions before we...
I do. I was going to say, I agree with you about the uninterestingness of that chemical-derived spirit. But just first off, when you're barreling things, you're talking about barrel aging. Again, you're not talking about wood barrels, right? Stainless containers?
I'm talking, in my case, about wood barrels. So,
oh, okay.
But in the
it was the eau de vie.
Eastern European or eau
de vie. Oh, gotcha.
We're talking about too. So today, our production, we for many years experimented with American oak barrels. I desperately wanted to make a spirit, a brandy, utilizing American oak, but I wasn't able to. I never really liked the results very much. American oak, Quercus alba, really wants to make bourbon. You know, it really, really does. It doesn't, for my taste, it just doesn't really go nearly as well with fruit-based spirits. So we're now 100% French oak. Well, 100, we have some Eastern European oak, a little bit of Hungarian oak, but we're almost 100% French oak. From mostly two forests, but three. It's mostly Limousin, a little bit of Troncée wood. So if you look at the species of oak that are generally available for aging spirits or wines in, American Quercus alba, French
Limousin,
Petrea and Quercus robar, so that's sessile and pedunculate oak. We're really almost 100% pedunculate oak, Quercus robar. And as I said, I'm going over to Cognac in a week and a half now. We do sort of an annual buying trip, where we're really now moving towards sourcing wood directly from the forest, and then we're doing aging there in Cognac ourselves, and then we have a cooper do it for us, but we're sort of in control of our own wood sources, aging, and then coopering, and then bringing those final coopered barrels back, because the barrels and the wood themselves have to be aged before, not the barrels, but the wood has to be aged before we'll make a barrel out of it. So all our wood is aged 3.5 years before even making a stave. So, you know, this year we'll go and buy wood. It'll be rough split to staves. Those will be stacked for 3.5 to 4 years, at which point we'll bring those aged staves in, prepare the barrel, toast the barrel.
But you put a toast on it as opposed to a heavier char like a whiskey does.
Yeah, and the reason is because the largest difference between American oak, Quercus alba, and all the European oak species is that American oak has essentially no tannin, none. And so it gives really no structure or mouthfeel, if you will. If you toast an American oak barrel, it doesn't give you nearly the structure of the mouth. The charring, really helps develop structure in spirits that are placed in American oak barrels. But the European oak species, especially Quercus robar, have really a high amount of tannin, and that helps the mouthfeel. And also the vanillin structure is quite different in the French, and the aromatic characteristics are much different in the French than the American oak. It turns out in wine, it's not as big a difference because you have tannin coming directly from the fruit that's going into those barrels. You don't really need the wood as a source of tannin. But in spirits, we don't really have any tannin in the raw spirit going in those barrels. And so we look to the wood to be able to give structure to the brandies.
That's interesting. I had another question about your still, and you were talking about how your condenser is extra large so that you can increase the contact time with your copper in vapor form. And so what would be the difference between extending your swan neck, your Linn arm, and increasing copper contact that way?
Ah, because that gives you reflux back into the still. So if you go up, so if you look at a Scotch whiskey still, they have these very long, hats on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that
mm-hmm.
increases the reflux. So you could, once you're over the top of the swan's neck, over that peak, right, there's no more reflux going back into the still. So you could make that run longer, except now you need a longer building. When you put it into the, right, so you coil it in the top of the condenser, and it's compact instead of running it straight.
Gotcha.
Anything that happens before that peak of the swan's neck is going to give you reflux back in the still. Anything that happens after it, now you have to coil that copper somewhere.
I did a similar thing, and I elongated my Linn arm, and it's about 9 feet now, but it's angled down. So if I get any of that kind of reflux, it goes actually down to the condenser instead of falling back into the pot.
Everything past your peak point goes to the condenser, and everything on the other side goes back into the pot.
Yeah. That's true. There you go.
So, Dan, I want to close out the show with us talking about apple brandy, but will you cover the XO with us and just explain how it's different from the rare alembic? And also, we've got the heritage alembic brandy, so we've been tasting the XO, but I definitely would like to hear about it before we hear about the heritage.
Sure. So, a couple things. So once we do the distillation, the brandy's going barrel. We talked a little bit about the barrels. Now we're really looking for transformation of elements. So the brandies go in, and I know you asked about the XO. The brandies go into barrel new wood for about 6 to 12 months. New wood is whatever. We want to put a little bit of oak on these brandies because that will really form a pedestal or a framework with which they can age. And once that 6 months to a year has passed with new wood, we don't want to keep the brandies in active oak anymore. We want to move them over into old oak, things that are no longer giving oak character, but are actually acting as an aging vessel, They do a little more than that. And as time progresses, we move the brandies into older and older and older oak. And some of the most precious oak in our distillery is almost 80 years old now. Because more than just putting spirit into a barrel and closing the lid and letting time pass and opening it up, the development of great characteristics in brandy is all about sort of a nurturing process to sort of bring out to bring out the aspects that are present in the in those eau de vie and present in those aging brandies to really get them to shine through in where they should. And part of that, as you lose, let's say, 3 or 4% to the angel share every year through evaporative losses through those barrels, what's left behind gets more and more and more concentrated. And it also concentrates in the wood. And our chai, our rickhouse, if you will, but the French word is chai, our chai was built to age only barrels. It's the straw bale we went to, but the high humidity chai is the 3-foot-thick straw bale walls. Actually it's 2.5-foot-thick straw bale walls and a living roof with very high humidity, natural dirt floor. And we're aging the wood. We're aging the barrels. We're growing the microflora and microfauna in that room, which over time actually act to interact with the solids that are now present in those old barrels and those old wood barrels. And they give forth very unique characters that we call rancio. So when you taste the XO, you're now tasting a blend of brandies that are from about 14, pushing 20 years old. That is a blend that we put together that showcases the sort of very bright, floral, fruity aspect of California Alembic brandy with now the elements of aged spirit coming in. Some of that rancio, some of the dried citrus peel, the little bit of cedar and tobacco leaf and coconut. Those elements really are coming in through the aging process. They weren't there if you tasted the rare, but they are there in the XO because those are all notes that develop in barrel. And those old, old barrels, those ones that have seen brandy for decades and decades and decades, have this rancio. They're the ones that really are able to sort of to really give structure and to the brandies. And the heritage, I could just quickly, is the oldest brandies that we've released from the chai. And there, the focus is really on the rancio portion. And you see that kumquat and the coconut and the coffee. All those elements really are things that develop in barrel. And what we're looking for in brandy, which is really, I think, different than what we're looking for in whiskey, is in brandy, and now if you taste those things, they're going to be much longer on your palate, is we're looking for motion, and we're looking for change. We're looking for an entry flavor and an entry profile and a progression over the mouth and in the mouth, and then a long tail, if you will, of flavors that are left on the palate that are still evolving long after you've actually put the glass down. And that's something really quite different philosophically between brandies and whiskeys. In whiskeys, we typically look for bold expressions of flavor, very bright, very strong, very clear expressions of flavor. But we're not as much looking for this sort of motion and fluidity in terms of the flavor profile on the palate. And in brandy, we spend so much time suppling up the mouth. So the structure in the mouth really develops when the brandies get below about 45% alcohol. And we slowly bring them down. If they're going to go for 60, 70 years, we'll let them come down on their own. If they're going to go for only 20 years, we'll slowly dilute them down with rainwater. But in fact, we age that water. We make something called seb, which is so most of my aging room is dedicated to aging water, to slowly be able to dilute those brandies with aged water.
Oh, wow.
And that's because by doing it that way, you're able to get this richness and roundness and suppleness in the mouth that you would never get. And there's a big difference, a huge difference between taking – a cask strength, if you will, brandy that maybe is 64-65% alcohol, and adding water to it, and taking 12 years and adding 12-year-old water to that brandy over a 12-year time frame and bringing it down that way. And the reason is because when you're looking for complexity in the spirit, you want as many chemical reactions as possible, the ones you want, to go. And if you keep it at high alcohol, you inhibit a lot of reactions that are going to involve water. And so what we want those brandies to do is we want them to age over the entire water content, if you will, that they're going to see, that they're going to see. We don't want to bring them down fast because we want to age them at low spirit. We want to age them at 64% alcohol, at 54% alcohol, 50%, 45%, 43%, 42%, and then finally at 40%. And if you do that over decades, you really develop this complexity of structure. And it's really, I think, poorly understood as to why brandy manufacturers do that. It's much more expensive to do it that way. We would save, each barrel that we're buying today is costing us around $1,400 per barrel. They're 90 to 100 gallon barrels, but they're still $1,400 a barrel. If I stored all my brandy at 65% alcohol, I'd save a fortune on wood, an absolute fortune. But you wouldn't get this type of structure. And so
I thought my business was bad until you started aging. Yeah. Dan told me this before, so I've heard this story, man. But the reason I wanted you guys to hear it, because the guy's he's the best. I mean, nobody tells a story like that.
Yeah, you know, but, you came recommended to
normally,
me from
normally
John.
I say that he's actually the most honest guy in the business, but after that line, I got to take that comment back.
Do you guys have any? I really want to touch on apple brandy, and I'm sure Wes does as well. Do you guys have anything that you want to ask about the brandy before, or about the, you know, the grape based brandy before we move on to the apple?
My question pertains to the apple.
Okay. Is everybody? So, Dan,
I've got a quick question, real quick. Water composition, is it easier to control whenever you're aging that water? Is it easier to just go in there with distilled water, or are you just taking raw product? You mentioned rainwater before.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to grasp how many different variables you're working with. And is it easier to start with distilled water, or do you want to go in there with?
No. The water has to be really, really, really soft, or you'll precipitate out a lot of fat. So, but I sort of jokingly, but really not, say that I live 4 miles as a crow flies from the largest known distillery in the universe. So, the Pacific Ocean. so we're fortunate in that we can wait. Not this year, we're not fortunate, but in most years, we can wait, you know, for a front to come through, wait a couple hours. We have a water collection system. That water is amazingly soft. It's just come off the Pacific Ocean. And so we can collect rainwater. But if you don't do that, you need to use distilled water. Yeah.
Okay. How do you age it? And in what containers and such?
So that's a good question. To preserve it, we need to blend it down with brandies, and we bring it, you know, to between 15-20% alcohol, let's say, slowly. It takes a couple of years to do that. And then we age that low alcohol water, or, you know, high alcohol water, or very, very low alcohol brandy. It's called feb. And we age that feb, and then over time we can use that feb to bring the brandies that we need to bring down slowly. So we're constantly making an aging feb every year.
When you're adding that brandy to the water, are you using some of the seconds, or is that otherwise good brandy, or
it's otherwise great brandy? Yeah.
Same quality that you're going to be ultimately adding that water to.
Yeah. I mean, I just had a conversation with somebody today that sort of said, oh, you're a brandy manufacturer. Oh, you know, you use, you know, what, you know, tainted wine, or, you know, I was like, no, you crazy? This is some funny concept. It's like, you know, it's like, right, whiskey producers, they what? The beer batches that they were going to pour down the sink? That's what they're distilling? No. You're mashing your highest quality grains and your highest quality grain bill, and you're spending as much time, you know, on your mash cycle making wort for whiskey production as you would for beer. No, it's no different. In the same way that all the wine and all the brandy that's going into all those aspects of production, they really do have to be of the highest quality.
Dan, I had a question about that. Just curious, are all of your products racked down? I mean, you don't distill any of your fruit, or do you distill any of your fruit on the grain, or on the fruit, I should say?
No, we don't, because that's a really good question. Because the Alembic Charente, while I said it's the greatest instrument brewer for this, it's not the greatest instrument for that. So for eau de vie production, you do use a bain-marie still. You use a steam jacketed still, because we can only get up to maybe, you know, a few percent, let's say 10% solids in the still, before we would burn. And so it's not.
So it's just the actual juice, not like, because isn't that more like
juice?
It's just, that's more like grappa and the eau de vie, right? Where, I mean, you're just using the actual juice, none of
right.
the stems and the seeds
right.
and all that and the skin. Okay, cool.
Right. And that would be the same with Armagnac. It would be the same with Cognac. It would
yeah.
be the same with Calvados. Although Armagnac can use a continuous still, as well as an Alembic Chardonnay.
So you guys, let's move on, because the show is, I mean, we want to get everything in, and we'd love to talk about the apple brandy, because I know the boys want to drink the apple brandy.
Yes.
So they're sniffing it and letting me know it smells really good.
Well, so the apple brandy, I'll let you guys ask questions, but I'll say just a couple things. Unlike the grape brandy, the apple brandy is a blend of about 12 or 14 different varietals of apples, but they're all field blended. So the grape brandies, I talked about the individual varieties that go into it, but the grape brandies are all fermented and distilled as separate varietals and then aged separately and then blended back. The apples, we actually co-ferment all the apples. Unlike in Calvados, we don't actually age our ciders. So in Calvados, ciders are typically aged for a minimum of 1 year prior to distillation. They're aged in wood, and we don't. We do all our fermentations in stainless steel cold. All our fermentations are wild. I should have mentioned that early on. We experimented with a lot of different yeasts, but we've since gone to all natural winemaking methods. And so the apple is fermented on wild yeast, but in stainless steel and cold. And then it's distilled prior to being aged in wood. And so this apple brandy would contrast from Calvados, in a number of different respects, but not the least of which is really, it doesn't have as strong a Brettanomyces character, because we don't get that strong secondary Brettanomyces fermentations, which I love in Calvados. I think it's an element of Calvados that makes Calvados unique. But our ciders don't have nearly the Brettanomyces fermentations. And the ciders themselves, while we use fully traditional methods that, you know, would be familiar to somebody, for instance, in Normandy, the ciders themselves come out more like Basque ciders, like Asturian ciders. Not really the high VA elements there, but in terms of the style and structure. And so they'd sort of really be dead ringers for Pyrenean type ciders, or, you know, Picos de Europa ciders. But then the distillation process is very, distillation and aging is very French-like, although we do use a small amount of new wood on our apple cider, and many producers in Normandy use only neutral wood. So that's a little bit of a contrast there.
Why did you make the decision not to age the apples or age the cider before you went on? Yeah.
You know, a colleague of mine, you know, at one point we were doing this and doing some tests, and I sort of said, you know, like, we really, I you know, the apple brandies are
crisp and clear, but they just, you know, they don't have that character of Calvados. And he's French, and he said, but what should I say? You know, we are in America. I mean, why you want to make Calvados? He's trying to get away from that because he's French. But the point is...
He's big wine come out my nose.
I think the real point was that, like, we do want to do something new here, new and different. And I said this recently, and I think it's really true, especially in distillation, even more so than almost any other aspect in food and wine that I can think of. You know, there were great distillers hundreds of years ago. People, as I said, I have one piece of equipment that they wouldn't have had, and you could actually do without it if you were careful. You know, really great distillers have gone before us and really developed the techniques and the styles that today we associate with some of the greatest beverages in the world. And the real difficulty, I think, in the world of distillation today is bringing something new to an area that has had so many great minds and great noses go over it inch by inch and millimeter by millimeter for hundreds of years. So it's, you know, just, I'm not a firm believer in novelty for novelty's sake. I absolutely believe that there are things that this generation of distiller can bring to the table that can bring fresh new insights, you know, newer techniques, but it doesn't mean throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And so what we're looking to do here in California is to take all the quality factors that have been for centuries identified with the great spirits of Europe and be able to achieve those quality factors in ways that we can do here. So, I mean, we could go on about like how the fruit ripens here versus how it ripens in Cognac. But the fact of the matter is the character of the fruit that they want in Cognac is the character of the fruit that we want here. But we need to achieve those things in different ways. And in the same way, we want to sort of have an American or a California fingerprint stylistically on what we do within the context of having the spirits be in the classical styles, because those have been created and developed, you know, for many, many reasons, but most of which because they're really, those elements are desirable. So why don't we age our ciders in wood? Because we were looking for some, like, a little bit fresher, brighter expression of the cider here. And when we do the heavy Brettanomyces secondary fermentations, for us at Covered, I love Brett in wine too, a little bit, but it's very, very hard to control. And if it goes, you know, over to from cedar box to, you know, sweaty saddle to barnyard, you know, you sort of destroy a wine. So it's very hard to control. So a little bit of Brett is a good thing. A lot really destroys all the varietal character. So that's why winemakers hate it, because we started the conversation by saying that these wines, if they come from a place and a time and a variety, should express that. Brettanomyces tends to dominate that, and you get that sweaty saddle. It could be Sicily, it could be from Portugal, it could be from Bordeaux. You don't know anymore, right? Because
I can't think of anything worse than sweaty saddle as a
characteristic. Wes, you've got to have some. I think you probably have some questions.
You're talking about sweaty saddle and controlling Brettanomyces. I mean, it's such a crapshoot. I'm enthralled right now. It's great.
No, but with apples, it's really hard because it's easier to do with grapes, because with grapes, we're dealing with pHs like between 2.9 and 3.1. And apples, you're up at like 5.4 to 5.8. And pH of 5.4, 5.8, more like beer. You know, all of a sudden, apple fermentations are a lot wilder. I mean,
a lot of stuff will love to, you know, go off in apple fermentation. So the interesting thing is, some of our grapes are ML negative, some of our grape fermentations ML positive. We do, they have different style. We can actually hold lines here on gas, cold, ML negative without any loss of quality. But the apple fermentations, boy, the malolactic bacteria just are happy as clams, and we've really never been able to get our fermentations to go ML negative. And I have fermented them really cold. It's just that all that malic acid, that bacteria is just happy as a clam, and it just always goes. So all the apple fermentations are always ML positive by the time we're distilling them. But apple fermentations are.
Yep. Yeah, and that's kind of one of the fascinating things about the fruit. Well, just talking about apple fruit here and like growing in Texas versus growing in, I don't know if you're Central Valley or where you are in California as far as the apples you're sourcing. But I mean, we're hitting
on coast.
Oh, okay. I mean, our normal, just average pH is right around four. So we're able to control that Brettanomyces a little bit more. But, you know, like you're saying, you get it cold enough and it's just going to take off because that malic acid is just waiting. It's just waiting to convert. So.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, so apple fermentations are really a lot different than grape wine fermentations. Actually, we now have a 5-acre nursery vineyard here with about 35 or 40 varieties of apples that we're now going to be planting out in commercial quantities. Those things that really, really we haven't been able to use before, you know, large amounts of bitter sharp, bitter sweet, and sweet apples, because you know there really aren't any sweet. So sweet apples, if you go to France or someplace and you taste a sweet apple, even Red Delicious would be classified more on the sharp side because it's got malic acid in it. A sweet apple is like drinking carrot juice. I mean, no acidity whatsoever, zero. And so we're growing out quite a bit now of sweets and bittersweets and bitter sharps. So over time, you know, our apple brandies will evolve as we try to determine which varieties best suit our climate and style of apple production. These projects, you know, that's sort of the fun part, right? We're taking classic cider apples. If we were in France, we'd know exactly what to do with them and have, well, in here. We'd know exactly what to do with them and how, but then when you transplant those classic elements here to California or to Texas, the art is really figuring out how they fit, you know, in your local environment. Some of them are going to work better than they did back home. Some of them are going to work worse. And, you know, developing that sort of unique regional character within the confines of some of these very, very old elements.
Thank you so much, Dan. I think I've probably never been this quiet on a show before, but we learned so much. And I'm sure, you know, you have so much more that we could learn from you, but I really appreciate you taking the time and joining us. And I would love to talk to you again in the future. I'm sure we'll have other.
No, it's really, really fun. And, you know, today there's just, God, it's amazing to me, you know, having been involved in this thing for, you know, nearly 30 years, like the interest all of a sudden in distilled spirits and really well-made distilled spirits and classic distilled spirits is just, it's amazing. And it's really all about like people like you, everybody from people like John who's producing it to like new people that are producing ciders and people that are really interested in spirits and want to hear about this. It's changed the world for us as producers. Because, you know, we've been sitting here making brandies for, you know,
and all of a sudden,
you know, well, it's this it's sort of this educational process that's word of mouth, person by person that really, but it's the people that are sort of seeking out these things and looking for them and just wanting to know about them, you know, that doesn't even have to buy it, you know, but just wanting to learn about these things and know about them that's really change the world for small companies like mine.
Well, so I have a feeling Aaron's going to want to talk to you again in the future. I just feel it. So maybe as
Actually, oh, I have one last question. Actually, a question with a possible follow-up. Okay, since you are the producer of a Calvados-style brandy, can we ever expect a California-style aperitif gourmand from you?
We have been making it for 30 years. This sort of speaks exactly to what I was saying. We only made it for family and friends because there was no way in the world anyone would go and buy a bottle of Pommeau off the shelf. Compared to whiskey or gin or vodka, sometimes I think I should just take myself out in the back 40 and just put a bullet in it because it's like, it's great. Brandy is so, and Pommeau? Are you kidding? But you know what? Today I get so many questions about, and we make Pinot de Chardon as well. So it used to be only holiday gifts that we made this for, but we are actually releasing in the next year or so some small commercial quantities of Pommeau and Pinot de Chardon.
Well, I will be looking forward to that. That is amazing.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. And I'm going to say Osakalis Distillery in Santa Cruz, California. We appreciate you taking the time and talking to us. And I hope we get a chance to do so again in the future.
Yeah, you got to come out sometime.
I'm telling you right now, I'm waiting for Aaron to try to propose a story in craft in the future. That's why she's asking you the aperitif question. I know where you're going with that, Aaron.
And it's my favorite thing to drink.
Dan,
I really, of all the people that I listen to, Dan and I are in a number of portfolios together through a number of distributors, and I don't think there's anybody that I enjoy listening to more than Dan. He's very knowledgeable about the spirit. He's been doing this longer than a lot of these craft distillers have been alive, and the guy is full of experience. And he's also very poetic. You know, I did a presentation that I thought was really damn good in Chicago last year, and I had the whole crowd staring at me, and then Dan got up, and I felt kind of foolish about everything I said.
Well, when I put a shout-out for really, a brandy really producer, good. He was like, email, he was sending me your phone number, and you need to talk to Dan Farber. So yeah, he's definitely a fan of you and what you're doing, and we are now too.
Yes.
Well, that's really I take that as a true compliment, because he, as I said, is like one of the most honest and upfront guys in the business.
Wait, well, hold on a minute. And John, that doesn't mean you're right. Like you're just
two, but...
I don't mean in this respect, but I'm just saying for future arguments, doesn't mean you're always right.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. We will talk to you again in the future, and I have a feeling we will be seeing you. Thanks. Have a great night.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Did you guys... See ya.
Thank you.
Everybody got a chance to ask their questions, I hope, because I kept asking you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah,
anything I didn't ask you, yeah, totally answered. It, you know, it's...
We're going to go make brandy right now.
He does teach
right
a lot. So I knew having him on, it was going to be less interactive. It was more about, you know, having him really, really talk about what he does, as opposed to the shoot the shit roundtable that we tend to do. But it was really interesting getting a chance to talk to him. You know, Wes, his process up to, you know, just before the actual distillation sounds very similar to yours. The way that you guys,
I can't even comprehend the time frames he's working with. That's,
yeah,
that's incredible. But yeah, I might not try this one, but my kids.
You
know,
you just got to make sure you knock out enough of them so just at least one will want to carry out what you're doing. Listen, guys, thank you so much for hanging out with us, and hopefully you learned something and enjoyed hearing from Dan. Yeah.
Very much.
Thanks, guys. And if you guys want to follow us on any form of social media, we're on it under myhost.com and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all that good stuff. Thanks, everybody. Have a great night. Tick, tock, burn another-
another bitch, burn another tan till you fucking feel it in your shit stain. Shit pops, give this motherfucker, yo, I'm stepping on a flipping line.